Coming up on Path to Zero.
It was stunning to really just see the impact of a storm like that on Texas. It's kind of amazing because it really was a failure of infrastructure that caused that rather than necessarily a natural disaster.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hi, everyone. We're back on the Path to Zero and glad to have you with us. In this episode, we have a special guest, Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Findell. She's going to reflect on the one-year anniversary of the devastating winter storm known as Uri that brought record cold and ice to the Southwest and caused the Texas electric grid to buckle. During the storm, more than two out of three, almost 70% of Texans lost power at some point. Almost half had their water service disrupted. When it was all said and done, Winter Storm Uri was responsible for at least 200 deaths and financial losses of more than $100 billion. Elizabeth Findell's incredible reporting for the Wall Street Journal shined a light on the human suffering and fight for survival that Texans experienced. Before joining the Journal in 2019, Elizabeth reported for the Dallas Morning News, the Austin American Statesman, and the Monitor in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. Elizabeth, it is great to talk to you and welcome to Path to Zero.
Thanks for having me.
I've enjoyed studying your work and I had a great chance to look back at the articles you had written, some videos you'd shot covering Winter Storm Uri. I think you did really one of the best jobs that I could see capturing the people side of that storm. What exactly happened to people without power and temperatures that dropped to single digits? Still something that amazes me for Texas. Talk to me about what you personally went through that week. Was it challenging for you? And just kind of tell our listeners some of the experiences that you found yourself having during that week.
It was challenging and stunning to really just see the impact of a storm like that on, you know, on Texas and the way that it just shut down cities in such a wholesale way and had such a huge impact on people. I'm from a ski town where we get 400 inches of snow in a year. So I don't really think of, you know, 8 inches of snow or whatever Austin got as, you know, anything out of the ordinary necessarily or anything to be concerned about. But people in Texas really just don't have coats, don't have blankets, don't have a lot of things. And, you know, for the cold. And then, of course, no one expects this just wholesale breakdown of electricity and utilities completely going out and just not having water and not having the ability to buy food. And so just seeing how quickly literally everything broke down was really sobering.
In addition to her articles covering the storm, Elizabeth also did some video reports. Let's listen to one of those reports where Elizabeth was talking to people in Austin who were waiting in line for food and water.
Hundreds of people are lined up outside a local brewery giving away water. People are out here today with water jugs, coolers, pots, bottles, anything they can find to fill up with water.
I never thought I'd go to a brewery first just for water.
A number of the grocery stores have opened intermittently, but there have been very long lines to get into pretty much any store. Most of them were saying they were out of fresh food, they were out of produce, they were out of meat, they were out of a lot of canned food.
Wow, when you really listen to that, you get a sense of the despair and difficulty around that storm. Now, you were living in Austin, so you were living through it at the same time, but you're not only trying to live through it, you're trying to get out and cover it. Was it difficult for you to get out and move around?
You know, I actually got lucky in two really big ways by sheer coincidence. One is that my mom had been wanting to come down and visit me. And since it was the middle of the pandemic, she chose to drive rather than fly. So she had kind of driven into Austin that first day of the storm, and I had her car, which she had driven in from Steamboat with good snow tires on it, to use. So I wasn't at all limited in where I could drive, could go through any kind of snow, without worrying about slipping or getting stuck or anything like that with the truck with snow tires. And the second thing is that by coincidence, my water heater, which also controls all of the heat for my apartment, had gone out about a week before the storm. So I hadn't had any water or heat for about a week beforehand. And knowing that my mom was coming into town and was probably going to want a shower, I suggested to her we go to a hotel. So we had hotel reservations before this started. And so ended up being by coincidence in a hotel downtown where we never lost power and with a reliable vehicle. So that made it pretty easy. I also spent a lot of the storm just, driving friends and acquaintances around, people who needed to get from a place that didn't have power to a place that did, people who needed to go back somewhere for medication or, pets or whatever, who couldn't otherwise drive, drive places. I could drive anywhere without an issue.
I read a quote from one of the storm victims that you interviewed, a crossing guard in the city of Austin, Charlene Brewster. And Charlene talks about being a mother of three. She had children ages 3, 1, and 4 months. They had no power for multiple days, and they resorted to huddling around the gas burners on their stove to keep warm. And you quoted her as saying, "I know about carbon monoxide poisoning, but what else can we do? Is anyone going to help us? I have a baby in here." What was it like talking to people like that as they were struggling to survive?
It was really, really difficult. That family in particular, as you said, they had several young children running around this little apartment. All the adults were kind of huddled around a candle, and they had all their gas burners going on the stove. And, I felt lightheaded after having been in there for 20 minutes, and it was so scary to me. And the other people, especially in that same complex, who were telling me about, people lighting up charcoal grills in their apartments to try to stay warm, things like that. It was just so hard, and I didn't know, how to help. I asked them if there was anywhere that they, if they could get a ride, if there was anywhere they could go. The city had some shelters, but it wasn't, particularly well organized or clear where to go. And I went home that night and was just really shaken up and told my mom, like, "I'm afraid that I just saw, four kids who are going to be dead tomorrow morning." But I did go back the next morning, and they were okay. They had turned off their burners shortly after I left and were in the process of finding a way to another relative's house who also didn't have heat, but at least had a fireplace.
Well, clearly there were heartbreaking moments all around that. And certainly some of the people who were least able to change their surroundings seemed to be the most vulnerable at the same time. Was there a defining moment that was memorable, particularly for you? Sometime when you just saw the severity of the storm and the bleakness of that situation that finally all hit home?
I would say the most powerful moment was that family you just mentioned with the little kids and the burners going. But as far as when the severity of it really hit me, the first morning that people lost power, it had snowed, I think about, maybe 8 inches or so in Austin. And that was when people lost power. And, but it was a really nice day. It was sunny. It didn't really strike me at that moment, that this was going to be this severe of a thing. I went for a lovely hike. And then the next day, I went out, to report first thing in the morning and was driving through East Austin and stopping and talking to people. And that was when people had been without power for probably 24 hours, had gone through a very cold night without power, and the streets were just filled with people wandering, you know, looking for food, looking for water, looking for, you know, any kind of warmth, wrapped up in blankets, you know, talking about this traumatic night they had been through. No businesses were open. You know, streets, a lot of streets were impassable because people had tried to drive and gotten stuck. And that was when the severity of it really started to sink in. And then, of course, things only got worse from there.
You know, we talk about all these hardships, but often hardships will bring people together. Did you witness any of that? Any glorious moments?
Certainly saw a lot of volunteers trying to get people from point A to point B, people trying to check on each other to make sure if they were all right. I think we saw a lot of businesses trying to help, even though at first businesses weren't able to open at all. But as soon as they could, those that could were trying to help. You know, there were taquerias giving out free tacos if they were able to get someone in to open the kitchen. You had hours long lines outside grocery stores, of course, and they were out of most things, but trying to brighten spirits, you know, HEB was giving out free flowers to everyone who came in. Once the lights came back on, but there was no water, it was breweries that stepped up and gave out water and sort of neighborhood by neighborhood. And was talking to the owner of St. Elmo's Brewing in Austin. And he told me he had Dell Children's Hospital track down his number through a friend of a friend to get water. And he brought them a bunch of kegs of water, but he was, you know, a little bit dismayed that a major hospital was having to track down, you know, the phone number of a brewery owner to find water rather than having any kind of governmental safety net.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. As I was studying you a bit, I see you've had a long career reporting on politics as well. I know you covered the Capitol. Talk to us about the response that you saw from the lawmakers in Austin around the storm. And what did you hear from experts about the effectiveness of any new legislation that may have come about?
Well, of course, in the immediate aftermath of the storm, there was a lot of discussion of we can never let this happen again. What went wrong? But then, you know, when it comes to actually passing things, there's such disagreement and, of course, partisan disagreement over what, you know, what to actually require of utilities and gas companies, that kind of thing. The legislature did pass a bill requiring the Railroad Commission and the Public Utility Commission, which oversee gas and electric industries, to create rules regarding weatherization of gas facilities and energy lines, but much more stringent bills that would have, you know, say connected the grid to the rest of the country or just straight up required these facilities to weatherize as most neighboring states do. Those bills didn't go anywhere. So, you know, critics of the bill that passed will tell you that it didn't provide any specific requirements for winterization. It just asked the commissions to look at it. That process is still ongoing. There's no deadline for when facilities will have to winterize. Any winterization requirements will apply only to energy producers, which are deemed critical infrastructure, which they can choose to opt out of and not be designated as that. So, you know, there are a lot of questions about whether what was done will actually be effective in preventing something like this in the future. It's been heavily partisan, of course. Governor Greg Abbott was quoted saying absolutely everything that needed to be done was done to fix the power grid. But he's been he's been challenged on that by Democrats, including his likely opponent in the gubernatorial race, Beto O'Rourke, who's been really building his campaign around the freeze and around electric grid issues.
So is that freeze, I mean, here we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary, but it's still very much in the minds of Texans, not only those who lived through it, but those who read it and followed it, people like me watching from afar.
I think so. I hear from a lot of people, you know, if their power flickers for a second, they start to have, you know, a really panicked feeling, this sort of like PTSD from the storm. And I find when I'm outside of Texas, it's typically the first thing people out in other states ask me about.
Well, I think for a lot of us, I mean, I'll see an image often of the people standing in line with their 20-pound cylinders waiting to be filled, and just the hopelessness and despair on their faces is daunting. Elizabeth, we're going to take a quick break. Stay with us for more of our conversation with the Wall Street Journal's Elizabeth Findell, reflecting on the historic winter storm that devastated Texas a year ago.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com. Maybe I'll win.
Well, welcome back. We're talking with Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Findell, who covered the impact and the aftermath of Winter Storm Uri. So let me ask you this. I know you're kind of following this. We talk a lot about resilience. Talk a lot about Texans and their natural resilience, but do you have any observations on what's changed and if you think the people are prepared, the governments are prepared, even if the state is better prepared for another Uri?
You know, it's interesting because, as we were kind of coming into this winter storm a couple days before it got really cold, Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo, who's the elected executive of the Houston region, essentially, did a press conference and told people that they should prepare for the storm as if it were a Category 5 hurricane. And I really thought that was absurd at the time, just, being from Colorado and just the idea that a little bit of cold could possibly be as destructive as a hurricane. I think I mocked her on Twitter. And then watching it all unfold, it really was exactly like that. And I think that next time around, when cold weather is approaching, I think a lot more Texans probably will treat it as a hurricane and prepare accordingly. I think you'll probably see a lot more people, you know, stocking up on food, stocking up on water, powering up or, you know, filling up bathtubs, buying blankets. You already have a lot of people stocking up on power generators, that kind of thing. So I think you'll see people treating cold much more seriously. Whereas before this, no one ever imagined that the entire electrical grid would go out. And is the state as a whole more prepared for it? It's honestly pretty hard to say. I think we'll probably have to wait and see on that one.
It's really been difficult to tell, even as a person in the energy mix, trying to understand just, you know, what policies had fostered that lack of preparation, and then really what's changed on the part of power providers or gas providers. And it's been hard to see just if there have been significant improvements. I'm not sure that you, certainly not obvious yet. I think you'll have to be tested again, sadly.
Yes, probably.
So, you know, a lot of people want to link Uri to climate change. I guess most people will link almost any extreme weather to climate change anymore. In your reporting, I was studying you a bit. You never really crossed over in your own work on the subject of climate change, but I'm sure you have some opinions based on what you saw. So one of the fun things we do here is we have a magic wand, and we're going to hand you that magic wand in just a moment, but you, with it, you get to change one thing, one big thing, usually time sensitive in the year ahead. And it's about the way we're responding to, or even maybe talking about climate change. So I'm going to say that again. You get your magic wand. You get to wave it around, change one big thing in the year ahead as to either the conversations around climate change or maybe the way we respond or report about it. How would you use that magic wand?
You know, I don't, it's a little bit outside of my role to, you know, speak to anything policy wise on that. But I do think that it's clear that weather is becoming more extreme and more unpredictable, and it's only going to get more and more extreme and unpredictable. And so I think everyone really just needs to realize that and start preparing for things you've perhaps never experienced before.
Yeah, that's true. Nice wand work. You know, I didn't tell you before, I am an avid reader of the journal. I read it every day. I just find I can't even go to bed at night until I've at least read that day's edition. But tell our listeners maybe something you're working on for the Wall Street Journal coming up. What's something they'd be on the lookout for?
Well, we're heading into the primary season here. So I think we're probably going to be having some more political stories as well. A lot of border stuff is going on. I've been writing a lot about this program, Operation Lone Star, by Governor Greg Abbott to essentially try to arrest immigrants on state misdemeanor trespassing charges. And that's had a lot of impacts. So we've written about that. We're going to continue to keep writing about that. And so, and obviously there are still going to be COVID stories for a while. So I would say those are three pretty big things. The political races coming down the line, the border stuff and whatever happens next with this virus.
Yeah, thank you. All right, one last thing. When we started the Path to Zero, we began this virtual national forest that we really like to call the Propane National Forest. And usually we thank our guests by planting a tree in their name, in one of these national forests, in honor of them coming on the show. I believe that for the Wall Street Journal, you're really not allowed to accept such gifts. So with your permission, we thought we would change it up a little bit. And we'd love to go to the Sabine National Forest, way over in East Texas. I don't know if you've been there or not. It is way over in East Texas. But if you would be kind enough, we would love to plant a tree there in honor of the victims of Winter Storm Uri, and do that kind of as a way to thank you for being with us today.
Well, sure. I think that sounds like a great gesture by the podcast to those victims.
Well, Elizabeth, thanks so much. You've been a great guest. Thanks for taking some time with us today. I will look forward to following you a little closer on the Wall Street Journal and encourage everybody listening to Path to Zero to follow you on WSJ.com.
All right. I really appreciate the interest in this.
Well, I enjoyed your writing, kind of going back. It's interesting reading it nearly a year later. That wraps us up for this episode. And a quick reminder, if you want to send a note to comment on an episode or to give me a new topic to consider, just shoot me an email. The address is path2zero, P-A-T-H-T-O, the word zero, path2zero@propane.com. I look forward to hearing from you. With that, a big thank you to everyone listening. See you next time on Path to Zero.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.